Hey everybody, and welcome to NWR Connectivity episode 288. We're gonna hit 300 by the end of the year, I think. At least get close to it. Maybe it'll be right in the new year. I don't know what math is. Anyway, I'm Neil Ronahan. Joining me as always is John Reardon.
Hello.
And we also have joining us to talk about all things Quake Verge Rain, Zach Miller.
Hello, everybody. Math is hard.
Yeah. Now it's going to bother me about how long. We are close to 300. We should do something cool for 300.
We need 22 more episodes. I'm not going to. I opened up a calendar, but that's like way too much work.
It's not 20. No, we're 288. We're
oh,
see, math is hard. Away.
Oh, okay. I feel like we'll make it.
Yeah. That's what
we'll
think.
Make
yeah,
it.
three months. What is
yeah.
it?
Yeah, make it with time to spare.
Yeah. It'll be in. I was thinking. I saw the 9 as far as it being September on my computer screen, and was thinking it was like the end of the month and not the start of it. So yeah, it'll be sometime in December. Well, do something. I don't know. Maybe we'll get the old gang together. I'll see if Scott Thompson wants the podcast.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know. Send us in some ideas. We could use some help planning Connectivity 300.
What if you and I just took 300 off and just left it to the Alex Zander team?
Yeah. Blue Coin Cast is coming back for episode 300.
You demanded it.
But what I do want to talk about as we start the show is, John, we teased it last week, but you released your 40-plus minute Star Fox Command documentary that has interviews with Dylan Cuthbert and other people who worked on the now 15-year-old DS game made by Nintendo and Q Games. And boy, was that a hell of a fun watch.
Yeah,
thank you.
I really enjoyed it. I do like, you know, the behind the scenes stuff of knowing that like Dylan committed to doing on camera pretty late in the game.
Yeah.
That like would have completely changed that documentary if you did not have the video of Dylan.
I will say, like really, early, like I was contacting all those guys early on, and I was like, yeah, you know, if we can do on camera, that'd be great. Otherwise, we could just do, you know, like voice only. We could just do like a phone call type thing, and if we have to do email, that's fine. And then it became pretty clear that Dylan was probably going to be email only, and so. I then went to the other guys and was like, well, you know, a couple of the other guys were like, video might be hard. And I was like, you know, if you just want to do email, that's fine. So like the entire feature shifted to email only. And then literally like a week before it was like coming out, I got an email from Will at Q Games, and he's like, I'm going over, like, me and Dylan, we're going to film it. It's going to be on film.
Oh, nice.
Okay. That's awesome. Crap. And, yeah, had to replan a little bit, but no, it turned out great, and it was awesome that he was actually able to be on camera. It's easy. It's nice to be able to cut away to something that isn't me, for the same reason I had Matt and Jordan read the other interviews so that you wouldn't be hearing my voice the whole
time. Which I do love the effect of what you did.
Yeah, the Star Fox.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, how else do you present text in a video about Star Fox in a little box? I'd also just bought that CRT filter for After Effects that I used on their little avatars for an unrelated project. And so I figured if I could make use of that, it would be like $40 slightly better spent.
I think the thing that kind of blew my mind the most was that there's really no concept art. It was all just built in the game.
Yeah.
The guy was just like, well, I may as well just start building these models. Here we go.
That is such... And I think, you know... The only time, I'm sure that happens. It's one of those things where, you know, I don't make games. I don't know how this works.
I just try to learn about the process.
Right.
I haven't done it myself.
Right. But because the only other instance I know of where that was like a very distinct thing that happened was the original Xenoblade, where they just really didn't have a concept art department and they just started making stuff.
Winging it.
And I think some of the character designs in Xenoblade kind of, you go, oh, that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes so much. I've never knew that before, and that just thinking about it, it makes sense.
But I think in both, and I don't know this for sure about Xenoblade, but I feel fairly confident in saying it after thinking about what Paul Leonard said about the art design in Star Fox Command. I think in both instances, it's something where you want to do something big on a system that maybe isn't totally qualified to do what you want to do on it. And so rather than like planning out this grand scope through concept art, you just kind of go in and say, all right, what can we do? Can we go a little bit further? Can we build this a little bit taller? Like how far can we push this before the system crashes? So that instead of having this grand design and then going, okay, well, I can't do all of that, so let's pull it back. Instead, you're building out exactly as far as you can go. And if you find this, you know, area where you can expand a little bit further, like he was talking about, like he commented on like the Titania levels, he had the because like it was kind of like a flat surface for the ground, there were no mountains and stuff. He was like, well, now I have extra polygons, I can actually sculpt like individual sand dunes, like with a lot of detail. And he was even talking about like realizing that because the DS has no texture filtering, that at what the water texture they would use as it would get farther out into the distance, because there was no texture filtering, the highlights on it would flicker and it would look like the water was sparkling. And he was just talking about finding like these random little limitations and how they could then work with them to make it actually look better because they were just experimenting with it as they went along, which I thought was really cool. And I feel like Xenoblade is probably a very similar story.
I mean, you think about all like the, I mean, because Xenoblade is a game that I think I remember, like, Alex Calafi might have put that in his review of the North American Wii release, of that the textures looked N64 level.
They're not pretty.
They're not great textures, but, like, that's the thing with Xenoblade. It was never about the individual textures. When Alex reviewed that game, like, he said that more as, like, yeah, like, that's what they look like. The game still rocks. But because that game was all about scope. It's not about like, look at how accurate everything looks. It's like, look, Shulk on Wii is gonna look like he's like a bad pastel paint drawing of a human, but you're gonna be able to look into the distance and see a bunch of like enemies moving around and like do the Skyrim thing of being like, I can go to there.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you can imagine when you look at like the definitive edition of Xenoblade, where you do have, like, for the most part, there's some rougher areas, but for the most part, you have, like, way more detailed textures, in, like, the line of Xenoblade Chronicles 2. And suddenly, the game struggles to render much higher resolution than it was on Wii. So you can imagine, like, if they were doing much more complex textures on Wii, the game probably wouldn't run. I think the definitive edition makes it so clear how close to the edge the Wii was pushed by the original. Because you get this context of like, oh, this is a way more powerful machine, and just prettying up these Wii assets a little bit. Because that's the thing, like from a geometric standpoint, like the geometry of Definitive Edition versus the original in terms of landscapes and stuff is, I believe, identical. So all you're doing is changing materials, and like the Switch is like, that's a lot to do. So it just goes to show like the scale of that game is a bit even on a modern console, not like the Wii.
No, I mean, it's something that I miss a little bit about Nintendo's handhelds is that, I guess Switch is technically a handheld, but, like, there's a lot of those, like, even just the Gunpei Yokoi thing of lateral thinking, wither technology and everything, that it's fun seeing, like, creators work within limits. It's honestly part of the reason why I think Playdate is really cool. Just as an idea, is because they have a lot of like, they have Zach Gage, Keita Takahashi, a lot of people making things with limits on Playdate. And you know what? Maybe some of those games are going to be terrible, but
they're trying.
They could also be really fun because it's like, look at these restrictions and see what cool things we can make out with them.
Well, that's, I mean, to loop it back around to Star Fox Command, that was something where they were hitting up against those walls from the moment that they started. The DS, when it launched, at least, you know, because you also had the PSP at that exact same time, which is a hugely more powerful system. Like almost a generational leap between, like, the PSP was running ports of PS2 games.
The DS would like barely get an N64 game.
And so the DS was not a super powerful system. And actually, something that came after the documentary came out, some other people from Q Games who I hadn't even found in my initial search showed up and were talking about it a little bit and made the comment that, like, this is something I didn't know, but I guess the DS has like a very hard limit on like the exact number of polygons that can be on screen. Like, it's not like, oh, it'll start to slow down. It's like, no, this many, and then you're done. The whole thing
just crashes.
Wow.
Right. And so, yeah, just managing all of that would be just a massive undertaking, especially for something as kind of like Star Fox Command is a pretty freeform game. There's a lot of variability and almost randomness in what could happen. And so just keeping all of that under control on a system that seems to, from the get-go, because this game started development before the DS came out, from the get-go, not really be suited to run it. And yet it runs excellently. It's very impressive.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the there's one thing that stuck out to me with the documentary was Dylan Cuthbert's comment about how Miyamoto views Star Fox as a 3D experiment.
Yeah.
Experimental game. Which
makes a lot of sense.
It makes so much sense for what Star Fox is, but even Dylan kind of, you know, details it in that to the public, in the 90s, it was Star Fox and Super Nintendo, then Star Fox 64, and those games are kind of the same thing. But internally, Nintendo made Star Fox, and then Star Fox 2, which is this, as we can all play it on our Switches via Nintendo Switch Online right now, just a really like weird roguelike-esque kind of like choose your adventure path through everything, and it's just a completely different thing. And then so viewing it from that lens of how Miyamoto and Nintendo did not view Star Fox as like it's a rail shooter game where you go on a straight line and blow up a monkey. It is actually a game where it's like, okay, we want to do some cool things in 3D space. Like, let's use Star Fox for that. Even if Adventures was, you know, made as another game, but I think that's part of the logic why it made sense to Nintendo and Miyamoto to be like, oh, we can put Star Fox in here.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. And I mean, it makes, so I have to toot my own horn a little bit here, because I had to check, February of 2016, I made a video called "You're Star Foxing Wrong," and I said I said in that video that, and I will quote myself, had Nintendo released Star Fox 2 as intended, we would likely see Star Fox today as a game about exploring 3D spaces.
Yeah.
So ha, I'm Miyamoto now.
You're the Miyamoto now.
I'm the captain now. and it makes sense in the context of, you know, the reason, like, Star Fox came out of X on the Game Boy, which came out of Star Glider, which are all free roaming 3D games. So it makes sense that, like, that was the mindset clearly that Miyamoto had when they went into development, was I want to make a game about exploring 3D. And a lot of, even, I mean, we know that a lot of the ideas for Mario 64 were being developed in tandem with Star Fox 2. Like, there's 3D models of Yoshi in the code for Star Fox 2. Like, those games are, like, very integrally linked. It's 100% a series about 3D space, and that makes sense. But I also would agree that, you know, while I think that Miyamoto and other, and Cuthbert and anybody else internally that worked on those games could see it that way, they do face the problem of, like, you guys can see it that way all you want.
Yeah, but that's not what the public
views. That's not what happens. Yeah. like that doesn't like, you know,
you look at Adventures and people were like, the only Star Fox content was when you were flying in the ship. Like,
right. Right. Yeah. You missed the key part of the series that would tell you that that's what the series was about.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's an odd place. And they talk about, you know, when they pitched the game, that they pitched a rail shooter.
Yep.
And Miyamoto said he didn't want to do that. I would love to see. I did ask literally everyone I talked to. I was like, you don't have any like pictures or footage of that demo, do you? And all of those requests went unanswered, which does not surprise me. I'm sure that ninjas would descend if anyone talks about it, but had to ask.
I have a kind of a semi-related question about Star Fox. I've never played it. What do you and maybe the larger Star Fox community think of Assault? Because I remember it being very divisive.
Oh,
it
rules.
Oh,
it does? You are the two Star Fox Assault defenders are on this podcast with you right now.
Oh, nice.
I actually think Assault has... I should preface all this by saying that... No.
Okay.
I should preface all of this by saying that I love all of these games. And I think Star Fox Command is a super good and probably underrated game. That being said, I think the perception of Assault got better after Command came out.
Oh, really?
Because I think...
I could buy into that.
Yeah, like... Assault kind of leaned into where the story was going with Adventures and kind of tried to match that tone. And Command then tries to go back to an almost Super Nintendo-style tone for story.
Mm.
And people were not happy with what they did with the story. Which is hilarious to me because the Star Fox series has never had good plots.
No.
They're not super complex.
I love that's one of the things I unequivocally always loved about Star Fox Command is that all the alternate endings are incredible.
Oh, and they're so insane. Not intended to be taken seriously.
Yeah, like the one where like Falco's like, "Yeah, man, we should race."
Yeah. there's one where so one of the characters you can recruit in that game whose name is Dash is the what is he? He's like the great nephew of Andross. He's younger than Andrew Oinkany. But he's somehow tangentially related to Andross. And there's one
Dash
ending where
Bowman.
He just
oh god, yeah.
There's one ending where he just kind of like turns into Hitler.
What?
And like has this like there's this like huge renaissance on Venom that then becomes way more powerful than Corneria, and they like take over the Lylat system, and he's like a totalitarian leader.
Oh my god.
And it's awesome. And it's so dumb.
He pilots the Monkey Arrow.
Yes.
And he's a fan of Star Fox. And he's the grandson
he's
of Andross, second cousin of Andrew Oikene.
There you go.
I do love how the second cousin. Which I guess that makes sense when you think about how it would be Andross's nephew and then his grandson, that would be the relation. Here are the alternate endings related to Dash Bowman. I forgot about this character. I don't know how
he's
I
great.
Could.
He's one of the best parts of the game.
In an alternate ending of Command, Dash stays behind on Venom to finish what his grandfather initially started. So he's basically just Kylo Ren.
He is, yeah. Ooh.
In the years that followed, Venom matches Corneria in almost every way. In time, Dash states Venom has replaced Corneria as the center of political power in the Lylat system. In months, a small conflict turns to war. There's another one where Dash converts Venom into a peaceful planet.
Yeah.
And then there's another one where he joins Falco and Cat Munro to create the rival mercenary organization, Star Falco.
What?
They're so good.
And he has a different ship because he's not a Star Fox fan anymore. Because the Monkey Arrow looks like the R-Wing.
Yeah. No, I Dash is like low-key like the linchpin of so many of the plots in that game. But no, like the Star Fox Grand Prix ending. That ending starts with like Crystal leaving Fox for Panther and like Fox being despondent and like him and Falco going out for drinks. Like it's so the tone is so wild and I love it because it's just like let's just lean into it. It feels like they've even talked about there was an interview with Imamura and Cuthbert right after the game came out with IGN. And they said like, well, what do you like? You guys ended the game many times in this game. Like, you end the franchise. And they were saying, yeah, if we do another one, I don't think we can go out farther than this game. Like, we'd have to do something in between the last level of this game and the ending scene of this
game.
Or
just reboot it.
Over and over and over again.
Multiverse, baby.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's... I kind of want to revisit and... replay Star Fox Command. It's been a very long time. I was not that hot on it when it first came out. I think I played through it when like I think the year after the 3DS came out, that first year when it was kind of slim pickings.
Yeah.
And I think I played through it again then and liked it a lot more. I think probably it was probably the like the summer, but 10 years ago, you know, the summer before 64 3D came out.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, Assault is great, Zach. If there's ever an easy way to play that game,
Wii U.
Or maybe if we ever see each other at a, well, Assault, there's no easy way.
Oh, to play Assault. Star yeah, Fox you're right. Assault.
I still have my copy of that game. If we're ever, maybe I'll bring it with me if we ever see each other at a PAX in 15 years when it's safe.
Oh my gosh, I know. I was thinking about that today. I was telling Gino, well, they might cancel PAX South. And then I said, but maybe PAX East. And then I thought, well, maybe not PAX East either.
Yeah. I mean, who knows?
You know, I haven't played through all of them since 2015. So if you want to do a Star Fox game club, we could just do that.
Yeah, we could do that. I mean,
you could do most of them in a day and then spend the rest of it playing
on adventures. Yeah.
Yeah.
I kind of like that. Yeah, idea,
maybe we'll throw that into the ring for potential game clubs to do after the Metroid One winds down.
Yeah,
and I'll get Starlink really cheap too if you want to throw that in there.
I just gave that to my nephew. if I want it, I'll just get it on sale when it's digital.
Oh yeah, that was
it was very cheap.
Like two Christmases ago, I bought copies of Starlink for like every one of my nephews because they were like $5 a piece.
Right.
That's like, why you get I got a Starlink. Mine. You get a Starlink.
Let's talk about other 3D games that might have been, you know, kind of setting the tone, inspirational, foundational, if you will. At QuakeCon recently, Bethesda announced a hell of a remaster for Quake. I believe Zach, I think you've played a lot of it. John, you've played some of it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I have downloaded it on Xbox. That is as far as I got. But please tell me about how this Quake 1 remaster seems really neat.
It's really good. I've never played Quake before, so it's really cool.
So are you just playing the single player?
Yeah, I'm just playing through the single player right now. And I downloaded the Quake 64 version. I'm not going to touch that until I finish the main game so I can compare it.
It's largely it's missing a couple levels, but it's largely the same.
Okay.
Game.
But the colored lighting.
It does look, yeah, it's weird. I wish you could so they technically they did add colored lighting eventually to regular Quake, which is in this version.
Mm.
But it's not nearly as strong as it was in N64. I kind of wish you could like download that N64 mod for it and then take that colored lighting and put it into vanilla Quake.
Oh yeah.
Cause that would look, you probably can on PC, but that would look so much better. Cause that colored lighting looks great. If you could have that in combination with the, you know, better geometry of vanilla Quake, that'd be great.
I'm really surprised by how modern the game feels.
Yeah.
And tell me if I'm wrong here, but it feels like it's more foundational to modern shooters than the Doom games were.
Oh, 100%. I mean, okay. I actually hopped on a bunch of the multiplayer, which is a it's
is
great.
There local multiplayer?
There is local, and there's also online, and the online has crossplay.
Oh, cool. I'll have to check both of those out.
So, yeah, it's very easy to find a game. Their default, like, matchmaking button isn't always the best. It's better to just go browse for rooms and just join one that looks roughly about full.
Okay.
But
like Turok 2.
Yeah. But no, playing the multiplayer just reminded me, I'm like, wow, this is, like, I knew that, like, Quake is a huge influence on, like, the Halo multiplayer too. And so like it's crazy going back to it and just being like, oh yeah, this is what every modern first person shooter wants to be as far as multiplayer goes, which does admittedly usually devolve into who can get to the rocket launcher fastest,
sure,
and just blow everybody else up. But yeah, it feels, it I don't know that it was the first, but and it may have been. It was definitely one of the early ones to do a fully 3D free look on, not on the right stick, I guess, but on like the mouse, where it's not just left and right like Doom or Wolfenstein.
Oh, yeah.
I guess maybe Duke Nukem you could look up and down, right?
I don't know.
I don't remember, but it would have been one of the earliest ones. It would have been one of the earliest ones to do that. And of course it did it with actual like 3D graphics, whereas, you know, Duke Nukem, I believe you could look up and down, but because of the, what is that? The build engine. If you looked up and down, like all of the 3D trickery they were doing just kind of fell apart and like warped really weirdly. So yeah, it's the first one of these like classic 90s early FPS games where you can play it today and it just feels, it still feels great. And especially with all of like the, you know, they've added in, you know, dynamic shadows and stuff. So like when an explosion goes off, like it actually casts a dynamic light on the room, throws shadows everywhere, and there's motion blur, and it just looks really nice.
Yeah.
Like you said, it's amazing how modern it feels. It feels like, you know, Doom 2016, or something like that. Like it just, it's very easy. Unlike something like, the original Doom or Wolfenstein, where you kind of have to get back into that headspace. It's very easy to just jump into Quake from a modern perspective and be like, yep, this is still good. Yeah. I still like this.
Yeah. Like the only thing I don't like about it is that it's got a terrible jump, and not a lot of the secrets, but several of the secrets ask you to make jumps.
Yeah.
That seem very impossible to do.
But yeah, I feel like I can usually wind up jumping farther than I think I should be able to.
Oh, okay.
Like, it's if I just feel like, well, I think I am supposed to be able to jump over there, so I'm just gonna try it. And it seems to usually work.
Okay. Maybe I have to press run first to get to some of these things?
There is. You should check the options, because I know they have different toggles for... I just use it with run always on.
Okay, I'm not doing that. I didn't know you could.
That if you go in running, that will make your jump farther.
Oh, okay.
So that helps. That. Yeah. Much like real life.
Exactly. But it's
leave the run toggle on for when you're trying to parkour.
Life's too short.
And the nail gun is great. The nail gun is so fun. I mean, it's a machine gun, but it's so fun.
Yeah. I do appreciate the N64 mod or what, add-on mode. I don't know what the official word is for it, but it not only replaces the game like with all the visuals and models from the N64 one, it also swaps out the soundtrack for the N64 soundtrack.
Oh.
Which, not that there's anything wrong with the original Quake soundtrack at all, but the Quake 64 soundtrack is the same person that did the Doom 64 soundtrack, which is awesome. And so it's kind of just a nice, like, that they went to that degree of effort to bring everything over to make it legitimately like Doom 64.
Yeah, that's super cool. That was cool. Yeah, I liked it a lot. Neil, you should definitely play it, and we should play multiplayer sometime.
Yeah, no, we should hop on and do some multiplayer. I recall playing Quake 64, but especially like watching the video that you put up, John, I was just like, I remember nothing of this. Like,
yeah.
I know it was a game that I played at some point in the late 90s or early 2000s. That's it.
Yeah.
It'll be fun to play. And I'm also curious, like, they have the couple, I do love that Machine Games made like two new campaigns for this. Like, it's just, it's super cool.
I haven't tried those yet. I need to.
Are those add-ons?
Yeah. There's there's like the main campaign, and I think there might be like an expansion campaign or something. From
okay.
Back in the day.
only add-on I could see it be, well, last time I checked was Doom 64.
It's in the base game.
Oh, it is.
So it's just when you go to start a new game, you have the original campaigns from like the original game and its expansions plus the
new
campaigns.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
So you can just toggle straight to them if you want to.
Yeah, that's really super cool. Like, just a really, it seems like a really great package all around.
Do you think they'll do the other Quake games? Because I know 2 and 4 are radically different.
I know. I played, was 4 the one that was a 360 launch title? Because I played a bunch of that online.
I don't remember.
I got a 360 at launch and wound up, like, I played too much Perfect Dark Zero. I had to go to the hospital for a while, get it removed.
I played a lot of Quake 3 in LAN parties back in the day.
LAN parties. Fabled mythical things that we'll never see happen again.
It is. I'm glad that I have been to a Halo LAN party in my life.
I've been to a few.
I feel like I'll be able to tell my children.
This is how we used to play games.
That, like, yeah, we had several CRTs.
We ran cable through dorm rooms.
Yeah.
And we played Halo across four screens. It was incredible. But that like legit had Ethernet cables running between rooms in my dorm
playing
Halo 3.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, mine was just in a basement with several TVs along the wall with a bunch of Xboxes tethered together.
Yeah, I think it was a rich kid. Humorously, he works at Ubisoft now. But it was a kid that I went to school with who, he had a birthday party that was like a Halo LAN party. And it was like they rented, like, I think they had like 16 TVs and Xboxes all rented for it. It was super cool.
So you that like was, each got was, your own screen.
Yeah, it was.
No
it was like one of the
anything.
First times I ever. Like, I don't think it was the first time that I played Halo, but it was one of the first times that I played a lot of it. It was probably 2002, 2003, somewhere around then. Because I did. Yeah, I didn't. I think I had an Xbox accessible in my house probably in 2003. It was before Halo 2 came out.
My most recent Halo memory is us trying to play it at PAX and using up most of the half hour downloading it onto the system.
Yeah, because at PAX how they have like all like the systems. I've rent the game, you can play it. I was like, yeah, we should play Master Chief Collection. I haven't played it yet. And it was like, we got there. It's like, let's play Halo 2. And it's like, you have to download the update for Halo 2. It has to install off the disc. I'm like, ah, crap.
Yeah. Yeah, and that remaster is huge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've since played the remasters and Master Chief Collection. They're very good. I'm looking forward to Infinite. And I know, John, you did mention that you have a Halo anecdote.
Yeah. So related to playing Quake and thinking, this reminds me of playing Halo. I then went on my Series X and was like, I want to play Halo now. And so I booted up Master Chief Collection to play multiplayer. And in that, you know, you have the first four Halo games. You have Halo 2 and Halo 2 Remastered as like two separate things in the multiplayer, technically. And then you have ODST and Reach as well. So when you go into multiplayer, you can set it to just literally let you play any of the games just at random as it's cycling through multiplayer modes.
That's really confusing.
No.
It is. So the confusing part is that these games all have like tiny little changes to how the controls work. And especially some of the remastered ones, like between Halo 3 and Halo 4, and sometimes, and like Halo ODST, they all kind of look the same in the Master Chief Collection. So it always takes me a second when they boot up to be like, which one am I playing? Let me push the reload button and see if I punch somebody. But fascinatingly, at some point in my life, apparently the last time I played Halo 2 in the Master Chief Collection, for some reason I inverted the Y-axis on the right stick, which is not something I normally do in shooters, so I'm not sure why I did that. But it remembered that, as Xboxes are very good at doing. Mm-hmm. And so in the multiplayer, whenever it would load up a Halo 2 map, my controls would invert themselves. Which is the most alarming thing to have suddenly happen as you go running into a multiplayer match and suddenly your character just starts staring at the floor. That was fun. But yeah, no, that's a good collection. I fixed the inverting problem and I've played it a bunch more and I'm not very good at it. But yeah, I'm excited for more Halo. I sometimes forget how just fun it is to kind of bro out on the couch with Halo.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's why I'm looking forward to Infinite. And I know there's December 8th, I think, is the release date.
Yes.
Coming out a lot later. Seems like that thing is still coming in hot, despite the year-long delay.
Yeah.
And the fact that, like, the co-op campaign isn't going to be there at launch, like, it does suck. But
though, in all fairness, 5 didn't have a co-op campaign at all, right? that was like a big deal when it came out, as they took that out. So I kind of didn't expect Infinite to have one in the first place.
I think they had said before that there was going to be a co-op campaign.
Yeah. My reaction to the delay was like, oh, cool, there's a co-op campaign. So, yeah, it didn't bother me too much.
I'm very much looking forward to Infinite, messing around with the multiplayer. I kind of fell off. 4 was the last one that I kind of put any time into and really bounced off it hard. And I used to bro out and screw around with Halo multiplayer across, 1, 2, 3 and Reach. And then 4, I didn't like the changes that they made with 4. I didn't like how they kind of responded to the Call of Duty 4 of the industry.
Yeah.
And how they kind of made changes to that. Cause part of the fun of Halo was like the more playful element to it.
It's like Quake.
Yeah. Yeah. Like yeah, really,
it's, very, I mean, it's almost arcadey.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I remember like a lot of my early memories of Halo is being the person who owned the GameCube, is I would get my ass kicked, but I would always have so much fun doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the thing that like when I was playing Halo 4, like, I've had times where I've been better at Halo than others, but Halo 4, I was playing this, I'm like, oh, when you lose, it's just not fun. yeah. Whereas in, all the Bungie ones, it was very fun, even when you lost.
Yeah, I heard very good things about that preview event they did for the multiplayer for Infinite.
Yeah.
So
yeah. I'm hopeful.
I'm optimistic. And really, I mean, I'll play the campaign, and if the multiplayer sucks, I'll just go back to Master Chief Collection, and that'll be fine.
Yeah. Yeah, and I should dive more into Master Chief Collection. I haven't played it that much on my Series X.
It runs real well. I actually booted up a little bit the beginning of Halo 4 before we started recording and playing that. And I forgot that was a 360 game.
Yeah.
Because it was just like a super late 360 game.
Yeah. I think it was, 2013, maybe? Or 2012,
oh,
geez, I don't know.
Wow.
Seeing that running at 4K and nice and smooth, unlike I remember it on the original system, it looks really nice.
Yeah. November. So Halo 4 came out right around the Wii U.
Oh my god.
That sounds
they,
right.
They both ended things. Just not the way you thought. So let's move on to another game that Zach, both you and I have played through to completion, Axiom Verge 2.
Oh man.
I love the game. It's incredible. It's super different from Axiom Verge 1, at least just in the way you control the main character. It's technically a prequel to the first game.
And the focus is totally different too.
Yeah. Yeah. Like it's not, whereas Axiom Verge 1 is very much like Contra by means of Metroidvania. Axiom Verge 2 is it's more focused on exploration, not so much on action, to the point where almost every enemy battle is avoidable.
Yep.
Which
even
is
the bosses.
It's just, you get extra skill points to use if you beat the bosses. Like, there's very few of them. I guess we'll go into spoiler territory, but even some things that you actually have to do, it's not necessarily like, oh, pump them with lead. Because your character only has, like, a pickaxe to start and then gets other weapons that are all largely close-range weapons and not necessarily ranged guns, which were the norm in the first game.
Yeah, and I think it's a lot... what am I trying to say? It's a lot denser in terms of setting up the universe.
Yeah.
I think whereas the first game was pretty limited to Trace's story and what was going on his planet, Sudra, but Axiom Verge 2, it's really opening the floodgates of, oh my God, there's so much more. I think it's I can't think of another sequel that has felt so different from the original yet the same.
Yeah, like it's weird because it's like tonally it's totally the same. But in execution and focus, and I actually saw some people kind of not liking it as much because of how different it was from the first one. And
well, I can see if you really like the gunplay of the first game, like that's gone.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think they did so many positive things, or I guess they, Tom Happ, did
Tom
so
Happ.
Many positive things to making the exploration more fun. Like, it's just a lot more fluid to explore than the first one. Like,
yeah.
I I have not done 100%, but I definitely like started going more item hunting in this than I ever did in the first Axiom Verge, because nice. Getting around that map was just more of a pain in the ass. And yes. I got to a point where I'm like, I'm just going to finish this.
Yeah. And now you can warp between save points, which is all I ever wanted. And
it's not even warping between save points. You can warp it from anywhere. Go to a save point as long as you're in that part of the world.
Yeah.
Because that's the other thing that I, you know, it's a little spoilery, but I think it's been like shown off in marketing. So if you want to go into Axiom Verge completely fresh, you like go into the Breach, which is basically a world that only the drone can enter. That basically like is kind of like a background world
universe
to some of the places that you go through, and you go in and out of there, and it just opens up a lot of like weird puzzle solutions. It's just a really good game. I definitely I've thought about like maybe I'll start a new file and kind of just toy around with it, replay it.
Now that you know where you're going, yeah.
Yeah, one of my favorite games of the year, bar none.
Yeah, same. It just looks gorgeous. Like the first one looked good too, but all the background, you know, it all looked kind of samey in the first game, aside from the color palette. Whereas this game, you're outside. There's very pretty backgrounds. I mean, all the foreground elements are beautiful, and you're going through these very different environments. That's a real fresh take after the first Axiom Verge. And the soundtrack is amazing.
Yeah, like I kind of went into it being like, I don't know if it's going to be able to top the first game soundtrack, but it might.
I think it's about equal.
It's really good.
Yeah, I listen to it in the car now. Axiom Verge 2, fantastic game. If this is the nice thing about it. If you haven't played the first one, that's okay, because it's a prequel, and it might do you better to play this game first.
Now, is this, so I've started the first one several times and never made it very far, just getting distracted with other things. Is it something where if I play the second one first, there's enough improvements in the second one that I'm going to like the first one less?
I wouldn't say that, just because they're so, from a gameplay perspective, such a different focus.
Okay.
So if you like basically Zelda games, where you can want, if you like Breath of the Wild, with some Metroidvania elements in it, that's what Axiom Verge 2 is. Whereas Axiom Verge 1 is very
very
contra.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, it's all, most of your upgrades are guns. And then the movement upgrades you get, there's a grappling hook and like two or three trench coats that let you warp through walls.
Yeah.
Not a ton of stuff. Yeah, like
there's still the Metroid movement.
But not nearly as much of an
exploration and everything. But like, it is so much of like I would say Axiom Verge 1 is like the thrust of the story is like kind of going from boss fight to boss fight, and like you find stuff along the way, whereas in Axiom Verge 2 it's a lot more of like, you need to get to this part of the map, how do you do that?
One of the criticisms I have about the game is that you get waypoints as you talk to people, but you usually can't get there anywhere near when they want you to.
Yeah, like I during like the review process, I got stuck, and I had to be like, Zach, where am I going? And you're like, oh, you don't actually want to go to that point in the map.
Yeah,
you have to go over here first.
The wayfinding in that game is not great, and the wayfinding in Axiom Verge 1 is a little iffy as well. But I think the strength with 1 is that it's basically level based or map based, so you go from one place to another.
Yeah, whereas Axiom Verge 2, it's all one whole world as opposed to like a couple separate areas that you're going to, which is a lot more Metroid-y, where it's like, you know, you're going from Brinstar to Norfair,
right?
Like that's more of what the areas that you're going to in Axiom Verge 1.
It's worth trying, John. And I think depending on what kind of game you would like more, shooty shooty or run around aimlessly,
explorey
Yeah, explorey. That'll tell you which one to play first.
Yeah, we'll see. I'll either come out of this Metroid Game Club being like, well, Metroid Game Club and then Metroid Dread being like, boy, I need more Metroid style games.
Or like, or never I'll come again. Out of it
being like, I never want to see another this, Metroidvania
this type
again.
Of game dead to me.
Yeah, so we will see where I land.
There you go.
I feel like I'm gonna want to play a bunch more because I'm not often in the mood for Metroidvanias, but this game club has really gotten me into like the I should just play a bunch of these.
The headspace.
So I may
it's
try
one of those
and,
things that like I've kind of liked doing the Metroidvania game club because it's reminded me about like oh like good ones of these are very good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because that, there's
yeah,
been,
yeah.
I will not name names. There have been a lot of games on Switch specifically with the kind of indie revolution going on there where I'm like, this says this is a Metroidvania, but this actually sucks. Like, where I'm like, I'm expecting like, this should be great. And I'm like, oh, like, no, they didn't. And no.
Well, there are plenty of them. That's a really good observation as to why I might have burnt out on them a little bit. There's plenty of them. There are plenty of them that are like totally fine. Not to say that all these indie Metroidvanias are bad. Like, there are lots of good ones, but almost none of them, maybe none of them, hit the highs of actual Metroid.
True.
Yeah. Or even actual Castlevania.
Yeah.
They might hit an actual Castlevania. they might exceed Castlevania. They just don't get to Metroid.
I mean, if everybody out there, if you haven't played Chasm, man, Chasm's great.
I need to play Chasm.
There's so many. I don't even remember which.
So Chasm's the one that I would say is way more Castlevania like in like controls. But it is a unique like procedural generation, and that I mean, like you have the seed to start, so you could set it to like a default seed or something.
Mm-hmm.
But it's basically like you have, there's like set piece moments that are the same every time you play it. And then the paths connecting them. That's where the procedural generation comes in.
Oh, that's so, like Sudras or no, keep talking. I'll think about it. I'll think of it.
But like, I really like the execution in that game. Cause I have revisited it. They also added a daily run mode. So it kind of like has this like, oh, like here's another, it's this seed. So if you wanted to play like the full game in with this as like a level base, you could. And it just makes it fun because it's a fun world to play around with. It's got a cool story too, like nice art, good music.
Sundered very good is game. What I was thinking of.
Sundered, yeah. Sunder.
All just really? Sounds like a ripoff of Heroes of Ruin for 3DS to me. Everyone's favorite. Metroidvania.
What?
That had procedural dungeons.
It did. End space RIP. So let's talk about one last thing for Zach. Blood Rain Betrayal coming out on Switch next week. We did an interview with WayForward, who developed it. It's being published by Ziggurat, who owns the Blood Rain license. But it's a way forward game that actually Blood Rain Betrayal, which came out on Xbox 360 and PlayStation 3
in 2011,
was the final game for a lot of the Shovel Knight people. It is a hard as hell like action beat 'em up.
Yeah, it's so hard.
And we had an interview with Adam Tierney from Way Forward. It's up on the website, you can read it. But Zach, I didn't play a lot of this game because it was very, very difficult. You seem like you have fonder memories of it.
I beat it. You just kind of have to get into the. I don't want to say get good, but it.
I was going to say get into the good.
Yeah, you have to get into the good. You kind of have to find your way there. But once you develop kind of a rhythm for the fights, it gets a little easier. But it's just it's a stage based. Run through the level and kill all the monsters. There's not much more beyond that. There is some exploration later in the game, but not in a Metroidvania kind of way, more in kind of a, well, now you have to go up this, you know, tunnel and down this hallway as a bird or something. And she's got a really cool moveset. I mean, she has kind of a unbelievable amount of attacks and attack animations. It's a really pretty game to look at, so I'm excited to see it in modern form on modern TVs. The soundtrack is really, really, really good.
Good old Jake Kaufman.
Good old Jake Kaufman. It's a nice change from the, you know, Mighty Switch Force or Shantae kind of music that he does a lot of. But it's so hard. I mean, it's and it's hard because the checkpoints are far apart, and Blood Rain has to, her name is just Rain, I guess. Rain doesn't get any health pickups. She needs to feed on her enemy's blood to regain health. And that takes a little time. So you have to kind of zip around between enemies with your, you know, slicing them up here and there. And then when you have a free second, run over to this guy over here, suck on his blood, get back to the killing. And I was happy to see that they will be toning down the difficulty a bit.
Yeah.
Thank God.
That was a welcome sight, because that was the thing that kind of held me back from this game. And to correct myself from before, this was not the last game that, like, Sean Valesco and the Yacht Club, a lot of the Yacht Club people worked on. It was, like, the second to last one. Double Dragon Neon was actually, like, one of the last games.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I can see that. It's a fun game, and now that the difficulty is being pared back a bit, I think it'll be a lot more fun for people to play. It's just beautiful. And it's cool that they're also getting the voice actors who originally played Rain and her father Kagan from the two PlayStation 2 games. Whose names escape me right now. One is the guy who plays the Joker in a lot of the DCAU now.
Troy Baker. The man in the arena.
That's it. And I had kind of misremembered that that game had voice acting, so I'm excited to, I guess, hear it with voice acting for the first time. I will also say that given what I know of and briefly played of the first two Rain games, which was really only the second one, this is the best Blood Rain game by a margin.
I never played either of the original two.
The second one is an attempt to do a, like, modern character action game, like a Devil May Cry or Bayonetta, but on the PS2. And it doesn't quite get there because it's PS2 hardware. So it tries, but Blood Rain Betrayal is, I think, much better and more successful as a 2D game. I read on Wikipedia that there was apparently going to be a 3DS follow-up to Blood Rain Betrayal, but it didn't sell well enough to go forward.
Oh, wow. Oh.
Yeah.
Interesting.
That would be interesting to see. And Adam kind of hinted that if these games are successful, there may be more Blood Rain coming. So maybe that could
be. Yeah, it's been... I mean, this is the only one they've had since the...
This is 10 years away. 10 years ago.
So the first two, both
2002
got...
2002 and 2004.
Blood Rain 1 and 2 got, whatchamacallit, new versions.
Yeah, on Steam.
Last year on Steam. I did not
know
that.
Okay.
But they're not really new versions. I guess they just add some options. And they look a little better, but I don't think they really... I don't want to say fix, but they didn't really do much to the base game.
Sure.
From what I've read.
Just putting it on modern consoles.
Yeah.
Or I guess modern Steam.
Yeah, modern platforms. Steam. I actually, you know, I'm halfway tempted to pick up 2, because 2 was the better of those two games. See if my memories of that game hold up. But I'm excited to play it. Comes out on the 9th. Check it out. Maybe we'll have a review.
Yeah, I think maybe we'll get a code from that. Should follow up about that. I don't know if we're gonna. We did the interview through Way Forward. I'm not sure if they're handling codes or not.
Yeah.
Or if Ziggurat.
They really
is.
Hated the interview.
They're not getting happy. It. They reached out about it.
That's
nothing.
True. That's true.
I guess let's kind of wrap up some of our game talk. I have a little bit of a quick hit, but first, disclosures. producer on the games that I'm about to talk to is Seren McNulty, friend of mine and friend of Nintendo World Report. So, you know, general disclosures, everything I say about these games
is a lie.
Could just be a lie. But I legitimately think that Sokobond, A Good Snowman Is Hard to Build, and Cosmic Express are all three delightful puzzle games. Maybe not delightful, because they get very, very difficult. But they are games coming out on Switch on September 2nd. So they will be out on the system by the time you hear this. And they follow on the heels of the same company, Drakneck, their most recent game, A Monster's Expedition, which came out on Switch back in early August. It was an Apple Arcade game last year. These three games are all, I think some of them date back like several years. Like I think like A Good Snowman Is Hard to Build came out in like 2015 or something like that. So they're older games, but they are very, very good. Sokobond is you're mainly putting together elements. So like you're putting together two hydrogen and an oxygen, in which they, you know, like Sokobon, you're moving a block around a grid to try to get things to line up in the right way. And there's also like it's a very nice interface of kind of going through it all, and they keep on adding new things at, like every couple levels, and it branches out in a way where if you get stuck on one thing, you can kind of kick over to another part of the map and try it out there. A Good Snowman Is Hard to Build is the one that I've spent the most time with. I've rolled some kind of credits with that. There might be some more chicanery coming post credits, but that one is my favorite so far, because you are going around and rolling snowballs to create snowmen, and after you create the snowmen, you hug them, and it's very pleasant. And you're controlling the monster from A Monster's Expedition.
Is in fact a snowman hard to build?
Yes. Some of them are very, very tricky. Because like you need to make sure that the parts of the snowman are of the right size. And if you roll a snowball over snow, it'll of course get bigger. Except for, you know, it can only get big to a certain point, and then it doesn't matter. Because there are rules in this world. But you need to have like, you know, the little ball, the medium sized ball, and the large one to be the bottom. And roll them around, and it's just like it's a very cute and charming game. That's my favorite, because there is a very like chillness to that, and you know, solving a difficult puzzle and then rejoicing by hugging a snowman is works. It just works. The last one is Cosmic Express, which is definitely not of the Sokobon format of the other two. This one is you are laying down train tracks to try to, like, you'll be like going over an alien to have them hop in your train, and then you have to deliver them to the right colored station, and you have to draw the track so that way, you know, there will be you know, multiple aliens that you need to ferry around, and you need to like lay out the track so that way everybody gets to go to the right spot, and then you leave the level. And it's so far that's the one that I've probably put the least time into. And it has started off where I'm like, this is, I heard that this was the hardest one. This isn't that bad. And then I got to like the second or third area, and yeah, no, I see how it's going to get real hard. Because the first area is all just like, you have one car on your train. So one person gets in at a time. So it's pretty like the rules are simple. Later ones will have it be like, yeah, your train has three cars in the back. You need to make sure that you pick people up in the right order, have them jump off at the right time. And yeah, it gets very complicated.
Yeah.
But these are all three of them are very good. I believe there is a bundle of them, including A Monster's Expedition, that's coming out on September 9th as well.
Nice.
So if you just want to wait for that, then you can get four awesome games in one package. And yeah, no, I'm going to keep on playing these. They're very good.
Nice.
But going on to our last game that we have to talk about, which is one that I'm sure no one has heard of. I don't think anybody's talking about this game or ever has. It's pretty niche. Under the radar. There's I guess, what is it? The 15th version of Myst came out.
It's the new nice Doom. Thing about this version is it is a new version of Myst.
Not just like a port or like some weird downgrade. It's like, was it like the Myst on DSiWare or something?
Myst was on DS and it was fucking terrible. I reviewed it.
It was terrible. And that same version was on 3DS. They ported that one to 3DS.
That doesn't make it better.
No, it does not. And like, nor did they update like the resolution.
Oh, great.
Like, it's just, they just put the DS ROM on a 3DS cart. No, but a new version of Myst, creatively titled Myst, has released on PC, and it also made a surprise release on Xbox and is on Game Pass. And I like Myst a whole bunch, so I'll play a new version of Myst. But the interesting thing I wanted to highlight about this, it's like ever since they did the Real Myst version of Myst, which was then updated to the Masterpiece Edition version of Myst, which was then downgraded to the Switch version of Myst. they've always had, like, you've always been able to move freely. Like, the original game when it came out was a slideshow. You'd click on a part of the screen and that would move you to a new image. And you would go through this adventure game solving puzzles and stuff like that. The newer versions are all fully 3D. And they have been since 2000, whenever they made Real Myst.
Real Myst was 2000.
Was it 2000? That's even earlier than I thought.
Yeah, I'm looking at the Wikipedia page for it now.
Yeah, I remember being ugly when it came out. Like, it wasn't, even at the time, it wasn't much of a looker. So this version looks really nice. The thing that's always, the reason there's a million versions of Myst, and they've never gone on to Riven or Exile or...
That was going
to
be my question.
The later Myst games had a really heavy reliance on full motion video for all their cutscenes. They filmed live action people on green screen and then would put them into all the scenes.
Oh.
And so when you're doing a game where it's all just still pictures that you're clicking through, that's really easy to do these complex live action scenes because you know exactly where the person's going to be standing and the backgrounds are all these pre-rendered static backgrounds. Problem they've had with and the original Myst does a little bit of that. There's like one scene where there's an actual person in the room with you, and then some other scenes where you'll see people, like, you know, on like books and things because they're magical books in this world. It's a long story. So the reason they've never done the later ones is because doing them in, you know, these remastered free 3D movement way, how do you then take these live action scenes that were shot in 1990 whatever on terrible cameras and compressed to all hell for these CD-ROM releases and make those work in Unreal Engine 5, where your CG game now looks better than your live action characters that you're trying to paste into it.
They would have to completely reshoot or rely on a CG or something.
Correct.
They'd have to do new work is what I'm saying.
Right. And so the interesting thing that this version of Myst does is this is the first version of Myst where they have gone in and replaced every single live action character in the game with a real-time 3D character instead. I kind of hate it. Like, I think the characters look terrible. They're very poorly animated. They did also re-record all the dialogue because the dialogue was also extremely low quality in the original Myst as far as like recording bitrate and everything. But the interesting thing about this is now that they've made that jump for Myst, there's now potentially nothing really holding them back from doing that to every other game.
Oh yeah.
So they could go back to all the other ones and do that. Which is an interesting, I'm not sure if I want it, from the standpoint of, like, I think especially like Myst 3 is like beautifully filmed. Like, it, if you just watch the cutscenes from that game, it just, it's gorgeous. But at the same time, like, in terms of making these games like accessible on modern platforms, and more inviting for players to play as just more of a traditional first person exploration game, I do kind of feel like there's some value in having a version like this. I would also be perfectly happy if they would just re-release the original versions of Riven and Quartz. Exile.
Yeah.
And yeah, just
so they have so Riven has come out on iOS, it seems.
Right. But they've they have not hit consoles. And those the mobile ports were a while ago.
Yeah, I think the last one was 2014 or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, they haven't really done anything in a long time. And there's stuff you could do. Even like we've gotten pretty darn good at AI upscaling. Like there's stuff you could do with those original games. Even if I don't think they have like the original 3D models they rendered the scenes from or anything anymore, but even just with like AI upscaling and a guy with Photoshop cleaning things up, you could do a lot to those original games because they're pictures. Like you could clean those up very well. And even the live action stuff, you could do a lot to clean that up. But all that, I guess, to say, hopefully this version of Myst, while it's far from my favorite version, hopefully it maybe opens up the way to making those later games more accessible.
That'd be cool.
Which would be cool because they're fantastic and everyone should play them. And I meet fewer and fewer people that have played Myst, which is sad because it's like the adventure game that defined every adventure game ever.
Yeah, it's talk about foundational.
Yeah, that and Quake, very similar.
Yeah, no, when I reviewed the Switch version of Masterpiece Edition, I said something to the extent of Myst is to adventure games what Super Mario Brothers is to platformers.
Oh yeah.
Like it's just that's it.
So I have a friend who has it on Switch and he says it runs poorly.
It has some frame rate issues in like certain areas. It's okay overall.
Okay.
And also it's a game where nothing happens. So
that's true.
It's one of those things where it's like, does the frame rate drop when I step into this elevator? Yes. Does it matter? Not in the slightest.
Okay.
Because it's missed.
Yeah. Like
nothing is this was a game that was a slideshow before. The frame rate's better than it was when it was a slideshow. So it's, you know, you can only go up from there.
Yeah.
I'm actually curious. I might pick this up on my Oculus Quest.
Yes, this one's
cool.
VR compatible.
Yeah, the version that came out on Game Pass is actually it's that version but adapted for regular monitors. Quest version came out last year. But now I'm kind of curious. I haven't played Myst in 25 years, something like that.
Yeah.
Like I played it sometime in the mid to late 90s and thought it was cool, never got super into it, but it'd be fun to revisit.
I will say one neat feature of this version is it has a randomizer option that
is cool.
It doesn't do a ton, but it takes all of the puzzle solutions where you can change them and changes them. So things like, you know, early on, there's one where you have like eight symbols and you need to figure out like which four symbols to turn on to do this thing by looking in these different places. And it just changes up what those symbols are.
Oh.
There are dates you have to look up in an observatory at one point, and it changes what those dates are to random dates. So not that I memorized any of that ever, but if you have played the game a bunch and just want to change up a few of the solutions now and then, I think it's a nice touch.
Huh, that's cool.
All right. Well, that does it for us talking about like foundational games for the 90s, which seemed to be a lot of the day. Let's go to listener mail before we close out the show. We have One Piece, kind of, I guess, maybe somewhat related to what we've been talking about, from Chariot Goblin, who writes, as everyone becomes excited for Nintendo's holiday lineup, one game appears to be lacking in conversation. Advance Wars 1+2 Reboot Camp. Do you think that there is a market for this type of game? Do you think its sales will determine whether Nintendo brings other franchises back or not? What is your personal excitement for these remakes? Thanks and keep up the great podcasting.
I'm actually pretty stoked because I didn't play the originals, but I've not heard anything but good things about them.
I played the first one.
Strategy games give me hives, but I feel like
it's way forward, man.
It's way forward. Yeah.
Yeah. I played the first one back in the day, and I also played the DS ones. I never played the second one. That's included in this remake as well. I I still am not sold on the visuals, but this might be like Famicom Detective Club, where I go in on it regardless of my total excitement level, is the naive way of voting with my dollar. Sure. Famicom Detective Club, I'm so happy that those games came to America. They are, like, if we're talking about adventure games that might not have stood the test of time, might be Famicom Detective Club. Like, they're very well written, but it's a lot of those, like, did you talk to that exact specific person in the exact right way? That the only way that you would have known that is if you are the designer of this video game. Like, it has a lot of that nonsense of, like, you need to trigger this flag in this very specific manner. But, like, as long as it plays well, I kind of don't care with Advance Wars. I think my worry is that I don't think this game is going to sell well.
I don't think it will.
No, me neither.
How about you, John? Are you? I think you've been more positive on the way it looks.
I think it looks fine. I've never played any of these games. I have no attachment to them whatsoever. I think this remaster looks nice, and I think that this will be a very expensive Switch game in like 3 years.
Probably,
because I think they'll print roughly 5 copies.
Well, it's not out in Japan. I'm actually really. Yeah. This has come up. It was not at E3. I'm looking Advance Wars Switch Japan. Talk amongst yourselves. I'm going to try to solve this.
Well, you know what's weird is that I don't like strategy games because I'm terrible at them, but a strategy game that's coming up that I will probably buy because it looks so wonderful is Metal Slug Tactics.
Yeah, I'm a little tempted there too.
It's weird because that looks like what I wish Advance Wars, a remake of Advance Wars would look like.
Yeah,
I'm looking at the visuals of this Advance Wars 1+2, and it looks. I mean, I have no attachment, like John, no attachment to the original, but there is kind of a weird, everything looks like a plastic toy.
Yeah. And I guess, like, when I look at the visuals of the original one, I see a bunch of dudes with, like, giant cartoony heads.
Yeah.
And I go, yeah, I see where you go from this to this art style.
Sure.
Like, it, but, like, it's one of the, like, if you don't like the art style, I get it, that's fine. But, like, I'm just sitting here going like I'm like it feels like it makes no sense for them to even release these games, so like the last thing I'm thinking about is what the art style looks like.
Yeah,
I'm very interested to see what happens with these games, because I can't imagine they'll do well, but like you said, Neil, like, is this just Nintendo of America brute forcing a game?
Like, that's what I want to know, the story. So looking into it more, I never knew that Advance Wars 1 and 2 on Game Boy Advance did not come to Japan until years later.
Really?
So famously, Advance Wars 1 came out on September 10th, 2001. Was the worst time ever for a game war to launch in America.
Oof.
Which, I mean, really, if we're looking for why did Advance Wars never take off, like, that's unfortunately, that's it. Like, yeah,
they had a
game that was early on in the Game Boy Advance's life, positioned to potentially be, like, an early success. And, you know, I would imagine that Nintendo at the time was like, okay, we can't market this game at all anymore.
Yeah. No. Maybe and that's whatever. Why they made them toys.
Yeah.
Like, maybe
but
they're scared.
So Advance Wars 1 came out in the West in 2001. The second one came out in the West in 2003. And then there was a compilation of both of those that came out in Japan in 2004.
Oh, wow.
And then Dual Strike, which was the first DS one, that actually did come out in Japan along the same time as everything else. But then Advance Wars Days of Ruin, which was the, you know, the last game in the series up until, you know, now.
What about Battalion Wars?
I guess technically Battalion Wars counts too. Now I'm curious to see if those even come out in Japan, because Advance Wars Days of Ruin was a platinum reward on Club Nintendo in Japan.
Oh, you're kidding me.
5 years after it was actually a 3DS game that they, that was like, I think it was a downloadable reward. Like, that's the thing, is like Japan has seemingly not cared about the series for a long time. It looks like Battalion Wars just came out, you know, worldwide around the same time.
So not only is this Nintendo of America just saying, like, screw you, we're releasing a game, like, the entire series has just been Nintendo of America going, screw you, we're making games.
Yeah. I mean, like, Intelligent Systems has always worked on them before that. Well, I guess, it was Kuju who did Battalion Wars, but the Advance Wars games was always an Intelligent Systems series. I believe it was, like, you know, Famicom Wars was one of the first Intelligent Systems only developed games, because they supported the development of a lot of Nintendo games. It's just weird that, like, I just don't know what the potential for this game is. It's coming out, you know, early December, which is not traditionally when your bangers come out, except for Halo, I guess. But that seems more of a necessity because it needs
time. Is the Halo killer that, yes, Switch fans have been waiting for.
It would be hilarious. Would be, it's like, oh, Advance Wars sold more than Halo. Who would have thought?
If Halo was a Series X exclusive and wasn't also on Xbox One, I'd say that could happen.
Yeah, you're right.
I don't think Advance Wars is going to sell that well. And it sucks because I think the games are fun. I think they serve a niche. Wargroove being out there, that is a game that I think captures the Advance Wars vibe very well. And there's dogs in that too, which is great. But Advance Wars 1 and 2, and I think some of it, maybe this is why I'm down on it visually, is that I don't think the visuals are going to be something that appeals to a wider audience.
Mm. Yeah, I feel like they could lean into the Fire Emblem lineage a bit.
Yeah, more. I was going to say, Fire Emblem sells perfectly well.
I just feel like every trailer should start with from the creators of Fire Emblem Awakening.
Yeah. And the creators of Shantae. And it's just like the two, it's like the child dragon character from Fire Emblem games high-fiving Shantae.
Yeah. That's how you do,
like, you know, this is the offspring of them.
Yeah. I mean, well, it's like, you know, the Recore reveal trailer where it was just like Metroid Prime and the Mega Man dude, and you're like,
remember that.
Okay. Like, yeah. That's,
I mean,
that's
that
how
didn't
you
work for that, though.
Well, yeah, but this could. The problem was that Mega Man dude was coming off of his, like, least successful, like,
that is
it was from the creator of Mighty Number 9, and you're like, oh, yeah. Good.
Oh, wow.
No one cares. Metroid Prime, maybe a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, realistically, everybody saw that trailer as from the creators of Mighty Number 9 and that Batman game on 3DS you didn't play.
So I do think, and Cherry Goblin, asks if the sales will determine whether Nintendo brings other franchises back or not. I think it would be depend on, I guess, one, what the expectations are for this game is, as is the case with, like, every Nintendo game, is that if a game does, you know, if the it's budgeted right and, you know, sells enough or whatever, then it's fine. Like, and sometimes those expectations might be a lot less than we expect.
Yeah.
But it depends, and this is why I want to know so badly, it depends on, like, how did this game even come about? If this was, you know, Nintendo of America and Europe being like, hey, we want to get Way Forward to work on a Nintendo property, they pitched Advance Wars, can we do that? Like, that maybe it gives it a little bit more weight, because maybe if this is a success, it could open up the path for more games like it to happen.
Yeah.
Where I always feel like there's that gap between what NCL sees and what, like, the West actually feels about these old games. Cause I always have that moment. And I was actually talking about it. I think it was in the Nintendo World Report Discord recently about, I did a phone interview with, Kensuke Tanabe, Risa Tabata, and, this is the guy, I'm blanking on his name, Ad Van Poole, director of, some of the Dylan's Rolling Western games. It was for Dead Heat Breakers, the underrated game on 3DS in that series that came out in, like, 2018, but I asked about the Tingle games because I knew Tanabe was a producer on those. I blanked and did not do my research and my homework right to know that the guy from Vanpool was also the director of the Tingle games. And there was such an audible, like, all three of them were involved in those Tingle games, and all three of them were so excited that, like, somebody asked about them. And I think, I mean, it's the kind of thing, you see it a lot with Japanese developers, that they don't realize that there's a fan base for their games in the West.
Oh.
And especially, like, I find that it seems to happen a lot at Nintendo, where it's like, yeah, like, a guy will go to E3 and then see that there's people that, like, you know, care passionately about these different characters. Wouldn't be even surprised if, like, you know, like, you know, Imamura of like Star Fox and F-Zero fame, like, probably didn't realize how many people like Captain Falcon, like stuff like that. Like, maybe something like this is the pathway that we get to see, like, a gorgeous, like, Western indie do a hand-drawn Wario Land game.
That'd be cool.
That'd be great if like, you know, there could be that kind of buy-in of Nintendo working with, you know, independent developers. Or, I mean, I don't know if I necessarily, I mean, WayForward can kind of publish their own game. They're a little bit bigger. I think they actually have a publishing deal with 13AM Games for their next game, which is a kaiju related game that, Zach, I don't know if you saw anything about.
Is that ever going to come out? I mean, I feel like that was supposed to come out years ago.
I think it's, I don't know what's up with that. We should bug those guys, see what's going on with that game.
I remember you and I were going to interview one of them and talk about Godzilla King of the Monsters. That's how long this game's been developed.
Yeah. I hope Advance Wars does really well. It'd be cool. I'm going to buy it. I'm a sucker for this kind of stuff.
Is this a $60 game? Or
probably.
Is this...
Yes, it is. It is.
It's two games.
You guys get that. I'll get Metal Slug, and we'll compare notes.
Yeah.
I think Metal Slug is 2022.
Well, shit.
I mean, I'll need something to play while I'm, like, away from my Xbox playing Halo, so...
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that that might be it for the episode. Zach, do you have any parting shots?
Nope, not really. Look forward to my very extensive, overly long, self-important Axiom Verge lore essay in the coming week or weeks.
Ecstatic.
I mean, have you been on our YouTube channel? It's all self-important lore.
Well, I have three documents going at the, no, four documents going at the same time. I have to just figure out how to paste and cut it, things so they make sense.
It's actually going to be our PAX panel.
Yeah. I was going to say, is it like a four-part Netflix documentary or what?
Yeah.
What is it?
It's going to be, it's the next 45-minute video to go up on the channel.
There you go. That's probably true.
As long as Neil edits this one.
Shit.
Good luck.
Neil, you're going to have to play through both games in their entirety and record everything.
I mean,
There you go. That'll be my excuse to play one of the Axiom Verge games, just to get footage for that. Yeah.
That'll be your help. I'll put it together. You just need to get me the footage.
I like that.
Yeah. I'll do one of them. Preferably the first one, because I already own the first one.
There you go.
Yeah. Now I'll replay the second one. I'm fine with that.
Okay. I like this.
Yeah. If you want to email us at connectivity@nintendoworldreport.com. You can write in with your thoughts on Super Metroid, which we will be recording. That will be next week's episode. Will be our Super Metroid episode, part of the Metroid Game Club. Go back if you haven't and listen to our Metroid 1 and our Metroid 2 episodes that came out back in July and August. I need to wrap up playing Super Metroid, but spoilers, I love that game, and I think it's my favorite of the three that we have played so far.
I agree with that, for sure.
Sure. I'm excited for... If you guys thought that me and Matt disagreed on things in the last one, boy, howdy.
Yeah. Matt has earned a permanent chair.
I was thinking about that,
Matt
too.
Matt has earned a permanent chair on the Metroid show, largely because we need an enemy.
Yeah.
Even if I agree, I probably agree with him more on Super Metroid.
I think next episode, it sounds like me and Zach might be the bad guys.
Yeah.
I don't know where Andy is the wild card.
Yes. Actually, that's so true.
The entire show, at the beginning of the show, we'll see where Andy is. Hopefully he's kind of in the middle. And at the end of the show, we'll see who Andy agrees with. That's who
that'll
wins.
That'll be the decision. Hit us up on Twitter at ConnectivityNWR. And we'll see you next week, talking about a last Metroid being in captivity and the galaxy being at peace. .. Or is it? It's not.
No.
All right.
Nope.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.